Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Karen Breslin. She's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate from Colorado. She's an attorney, university professor of political science, former policy advisor for the National Park Service's Intermountain region, and former journalist. As a public interest attorney, Breslin has represented community, environmental, and animal protection organizations seeking to defend the natural world. Breslin holds a BA in journalism and political science from Metropolitan State University of Denver, an MA in political science from the University of Colorado, Denver, and a JD from the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Derek. I really appreciate it.
So you are not a politician. That was not listed anywhere in the bio. So what made you decide to run for Senate?
Well, about 15 years ago, I had a dream that has stayed with me my entire life in the subsequent years. And the dream involved a moose, of all things, being tethered to a horse walking machine that essentially walked horses in circles to exercise them after they had been raced or otherwise vigorously ridden. And so this moose in my dream is being walked around in a circle. And that was disturbing enough, but the moose also had a broken leg. And so this animal is being partially drugged around this circle. And the moose looked over at me and said, "Help me." And at that moment, I woke up. Now, I don't dream very well at all. I don't have clear recollections of dreams. And when I wake up, I almost immediately forget what I've dreamed. But this one was very impactful and has stayed with me over the years. And I would say for at least that long, and really longer, I've been trying to do what I could to defend the natural world through teaching, through my legal work, and through my policy work with the National Park Service. And all of those endeavors have convinced me that until there's a significant change in the political system, the natural world will not be protected. I understand fully the concern about, you know, a system that's corrupt is simply going to produce more corruption. And I adhere to that belief in large measure. But I also think that we need to take affirmative steps to try to shift that political system at least toward less corrupt directions.
And so can you make the connection? I'm loving what you're saying so far. Can you make the connection specifically to the natural world? So why does that make you run for how does you running for Senate? How do you believe that that might help the natural world?
Well, that's a great question, and one that I had to think through quite thoroughly before making this decision. But in my estimation, we continue to function with environmental policies that were minted out of, you know, 19th and 20th century thinking, even though we understand now the devastation that these policies cause. So take something like the Endangered Species Act. All that law was designed to do, passed in 1973, was to prevent species from leaving the face of the earth. It was not designed to restore the ecosystems that contribute to the extinction. It was not designed to restore those populations to anything like their natural ranges. It was simply designed to prevent those animals from leaving the face of the earth. And we know that that effort has been unavailing, as limited as it was. We continue to use resources as if they are unlimited in quantity. We have no seeming recognition of natural limits to the use of resources. It seems to me that given all that science has been able to tell us about the impact of these policies, that we should be moving in a dramatically and radically different direction. And that would involve trying to think about these issues in much more holistic ways. So if you want to protect a species, you need to protect the entire ecosystem. You can't simply pull that species out of its natural environment and have any hope of actually creating a sustaining species. One good example of this, I think, is what's happening right now with wolves in the Yellowstone ecosystem. We now see that, okay, the wolves are not extinct. They've reached something like a quote-unquote viable population, but their numbers are being depleted as a result of state management. And really what that means is state destruction. So until there's some evidence that we have a mind shift, you know, a complete change in the way we understand the human relationship with the natural world, the natural world does not have any chance of rebounding to something like, you know, sustainable, healthy levels.
So I have two questions here, and you can choose which one, or you can choose to order to answer both or neither in whichever order you want. And they are, walk us through the process of you actually deciding to enter the cesspool that is politics. You know, what was it? What was your thinking that led you to actually jump in? That's one possible question. Another one is, so how would the policies that you would suggest, three possible questions, how would the policies you would suggest be different than those are suggested currently? Or three, I know that when I, one of the reasons that I started writing the stuff I did is because I recognized that there was a hole in discourse. There were a lot of people writing sort of shallow ecology stuff, and then there was sort of philosophical deep ecology stuff, and there weren't a lot of people who were bringing sort of their anger and their passion and their love for the natural world into environmental philosophy. I didn't see that a lot. I saw a little bit. It's like, instead of just complaining, I decided to fill that gap. So the third possible question would be, what was the gap that you saw in politics that you decided to fill? Do any of these questions make any sense?
They all make sense, and I got to figure which one to tackle first. Well, I decided to do this out of sheer frustration. I had done some work with some local communities that have been trying to further the community rights agenda, where local communities try to have some control over the destructive environmental activities that are being foisted upon them, usually through the process of state preemption. In other words, the state authorizes a particular activity, such as fracking. A local community doesn't want that activity. They try to stop it. They try to ban it. And then state law overrules the local law. That's one example of how difficult it is to defend the environment when even when a local community comes together through its own governing mechanisms to try to make that occur. I had seen on the regulatory side of things as a reporter that essentially the environmental laws function as a license to destroy and to pollute. And that isn't to say that the advances of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the important contribution that they made to cleaning up the environment wasn't and isn't significant. What it does say, though, is that it's not proactively protective in any significant sense, such that if you, in fact, want to stop some of these activities, those old sort of command and control regulatory approaches have limits to what they can accomplish. And Thomas Lindsay's spoken about this, you know, much more eloquently than I can. But that became very clear to me early on that this is a regulatory system that's really not so much about protecting the earth, except in its most, except when the abuses are the most extreme. Not in terms of protecting ecosystem health or at all thinking about sustainability. When I was with the Park Service, I saw that problem play itself out in terms of ecosystems, because if you take a park like Yellowstone, the truth is, at least in my estimation, is that it's just a really nice zoo, in the sense that a lot of the natural ecological functions just can't be there anymore because the park is an island of sorts. And that's somewhat less true and less objectionable when you think about a park like Yellowstone because it's so big and beautiful. But what happens to the buffalo every year, that they are rounded up and sent to slaughter because their population levels are far below what they ever were historically, is pretty good evidence that park is being managed to artificial human-centric ideas of what that population should be, not because that's a natural limit on the buffalo population. And frankly, it's due to protect, you know, allegedly to protect ranchers. So trying to protect parks, which are supposed to be places where ecosystems are the most protected, where plants and animals enjoy the most protection, is complicated by the reality of ant lands around those places being unprotected. So putting all of those, you know, connecting all of those dots and thinking all of those things through, the only way to fix that is to change the law. Litigation has its has its place. But when you go to court and you try to defend, you know, a piece of property, you can only do that to the extent that the laws recognize some viable legal claim. There has to be, in current time, relative to federal lands, there has to be a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act or the Endangered Species Act or the Administrative Procedure Act or the Clean Water Act. But if it's private land that's being destroyed, there's nowhere to go with that, largely, most of the time. So thinking all of these things through and coming to the idea that there needed to be a broader policy approach led me to think about, okay, well, how would that occur? And honestly, I mean, I think almost anyone who thinks hard about the environment understands that these deficiencies exist. I don't think this is any great insight on my part. But to your point about the hole in the discourse, we don't talk about it that way. And so where's the demand for one cabinet level department that deals with environmental issues? The Forest Service is under the Department of Agriculture and managed as a commodity, not as a, you know, as a natural place, as a series of ecosystems. So that lack of kind of demanding a change in how we think about these issues is really what propelled me into the race. Even people who consider themselves environmentalists, even, you know, well-known environmental groups, where's the demand? Where's the demand for treating these issues with the level of seriousness that they deserve? You know, and as to sort of what specifically could be done, I'm proposing that there be a single cabinet agency that deals with all public lands issues. And the effect of that then, presumably or hopefully, would be that those resources would be looked at in a much more holistic way, that we identify which ecosystems are most at risk and that we legislate restrictions on activities that would harm those resources, rather than allowing them to continue, which of course is what happens now with grazing and mining and timbering, et cetera. That we be proactive about what we allow into the in the environment, such as, you know, plastics and other commodities and consumer goods that are damaging to the natural world. So there, I think there's a goodly number of things that could be done, but to that hole in the discourse point, where's the demand? And I didn't see enough of that demand. In fact, some of these ideas have yet to really surface even in the mainstream. Like, why aren't we talking about regulating plastics before they're put into the market rather than trying to figure out how to recycle them afterwards? And so I'm trying to fill that hole in the discourse by raising these ideas. I also tried to take what I understand about the law, what I understand about regulatory systems, and what I understand about public lands management, and put, you know, pencil to paper or keyboard to computer to try to articulate legal approaches, policy approaches that specifically spell out how we would accomplish a more holistic public lands regulation system. And so, for example, if you amended the Endangered Species Act and changed it from endangered species to ecosystems, you would begin to conceptualize what it would take to try to protect those places.
So I love that. I'm sure you've thought of this a bazillion times, so you can help me understand my way through it. Is if they, this would be additive, so you're protecting species and the natural communities? Because if you just changed it from species to communities, they could argue, oh, that species doesn't really matter. We can just go ahead and wipe it out because the community will just sort of soldier on.
Well, I think that an ecosystem approach would belie that argument that you cannot disrupt a species in the system without disrupting the system itself, would be my sense of that. But, you know, but if whatever is the most protective, I mean, if it becomes necessary to be duplicative in some way, absolutely. But my thought would be that trying to protect the ecosystem would by necessity mean protecting the component parts of the ecosystem.
Right, right. So what has been the response so far by the have the Democrats welcomed this environmental challenge?
Well, they don't know that I exist in large measure. And this has been a learning experience for me as well. I mean, even as a political science professor, and someone who did a little bit of electoral politics in my college years, I probably didn't expect that there would be zero interest in the news media, for example. So when I made my announcement of my candidacy in July, I expected that there would be kind of a perfunctory paragraph or two in most of the, you know, major outlets. And there was none of any consequence. There was one sentence in one publication. So that, you know, that sort of signals then to the rest of the world, you know, to the environmental groups and anyone else who might be paying attention to electoral politics, that I'm not worthy of consideration. And I thought about that a lot, and I thought, well, that in large measure reflects the corruption of the system, that you can't be a legitimate political candidate in the eyes of, you know, sophisticated observers, quote unquote, unless you have a significant bankroll, unless you have lots and lots of money behind your campaign, and clearly I don't. The last time I looked, I think I had $638 in my campaign bank account. So if you judge seriousness and whether ideas are worthy of consideration, and you look at that bank balance, then you presume that there's nothing of any value in what I'm putting on the table. That I sort of did expect. But I assume that with just a little bit of public information that others might be interested enough. But it turns out that people tend to take their cues from others. And I probably didn't anticipate that as much as I should. So I'm doing things now to try to kind of get the word out and let people know that I'm here and I'm in the race. But so far, you know, that has definitely been a challenge.
So what do you think are the social and environmental effects of only people with huge bankrolls being able to enter positions from which they will make decisions that affect both human and non-human communities?
I think we're seeing the effects of that every day. And I think it shows up in that hole in the discourse that you were referring to. I mean, we're being sold a narrative right now about climate change that is, in my mind anyway, disconnected from the natural world. We're not asking the questions about climate change in terms of how is climate change a symptom of the broader ecological collapse and destruction that's being visited on the natural world. We're asking about climate change as a discrete policy problem. And it's a discrete policy problem primarily because it's having impacts on humans through flooding and wildfires and droughts, et cetera, not because it reflects an imbalance between in the relationship between humans and the natural world, or more to the point, you know, in industrialized developed nations' relationships with the natural world. Part of that dysfunction, part of that broken relationship is very much caused by the capitalist imperative to drive economic growth. So when we think about trying to solve climate change within that narrative, it's easy to understand why false solutions like electric vehicles and an electric grid that's, you know, powered by quote unquote renewable energies is somehow the salvation. And then what we don't have to think about is the contribution of consumption to all of these problems. We don't have to think about the waste of resources that is, you know, so abundant pretty much everywhere we look. I was thinking about this last night. I was in Denver and I noticed just how many buildings had unnecessary lighting. Whether it was enormous signs that light up the building at night, for what purpose? Because the building's closed and the business is closed. So what's the point of lighting it up at night except for advertising? Large kiosks, lighted kiosks that are just, you know, signposts or, again, just more advertising. And you just think about, you know, what message does that send to us collectively about the need to conserve energy? It tells us nothing about that because it seems like energy is unlimited and we shouldn't have any concern about burning as much of it as we want. The inability to recognize the relationship between a pro-growth model of economic prosperity and ecological collapse is why we're in the position that we're in right now. And moneyed interests want very much for us not to draw those connections. So it stands to reason then that the major parties would continue to pursue policies that are destructive to the natural world because the pro-growth economic forces demand it. And we have all been acculturated to believe that that pro-growth orientation is essential to human well-being. And this, of course, ignores the ways in which consumption leaves us, you know, impoverished spiritually and mentally and emotionally, as well as our bank accounts, that we have such high levels of anxiety and depression in this society and high levels of prescription drug use. We have all sorts of metrics of dysfunction. And yet the message that we get is that if you don't keep doing the same things that you've been doing, if you don't keep buying and consuming and doing more of that, your lives will be garbage. And if that's the message that we've all been encouraged to believe, then it stands to reason that when someone suggests to us that, gosh, we maybe need to stop consuming quite so much or be more thoughtful about it or whatever, that it seems like a real attack on who we are and on our possibility for a prosperous human existence. But that only works if you define human well-being in a very narrow materialistic way. And you take out of that equation all of the intangible things that we need to actually feel good about our lives, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, the ability to meet basic needs, the beauty of the natural world to sustain our souls. The pro-growth economic model has no room for those sorts of considerations. And so when you have a political system that's bankrolled by those kinds of moneyed interests, then they necessarily convey to us that those intangible but highly important attributes for human well-being are inconsequential and should be destroyed at will. And we see this now along the Front Range. Vast swaths of prairie are being developed into subdivisions at just a shockingly fast rate. And the developers, by and large, make no effort to acknowledge anything that was beautiful about what they are presently destroying. In addition to the asphalt and the housing that goes down, they landscape the stuff with nothing that is even remotely native. Largely with, you know, rolls of turf grass that turns brown in the winter and needs lots of water and fertilization the rest of the year and provides nothing in the way of habitat for any of the animals that were there before they came in. So that, in my mind, reflects a real indifference, if not outright hatred, to the natural world. And I think that is this political system's default understanding of the natural world, that it is, I never really had this thought quite before, so give me a second to put it into words, but it's as if the natural world is like, the special china that you take out of your buffet cabinet for special occasions, but then you put it back when the special occasion is over. So you take your trip to a national park, or maybe you go to the beach and you enjoy that experience. But then when that's over, nature goes back into the cupboard and the rest of our lives go on. And as long as the pieces are in the cabinet, whether that be national parks or beaches or what have you, then our relationship to the natural world is just fine and it's all it needs to be. And that dysfunctional attitude is, in fact, why there's so much ecological destruction.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I was going to say if you are running for office, but you are running for office, and you make me feel for just one moment as though I'm no longer politically homeless. And thank you for that, because I hear so many politicians and they're just so horrible, but and they don't care about the natural world. So thank you. I want to go to, I'm sorry if you haven't studied this in depth, but and if you haven't, that's fine. We'll just talk about something else. A great example of this sort of nature hatred, I think, is, you know, there's a recent sort of infrastructure and budget reconciliation packages. And something that we don't often hear about is exactly how much logging is involved in that. Is that something that you've looked into much? It's fine if you haven't.
Well, I haven't seen what's in the infrastructure bill, but I'm certainly aware of the idea of fuels reduction as a way of responding to climate change. And my opponent, Michael Bennett, is a supporter of this approach. And he has a bill that he spent about, I don't know, a month promoting throughout the state called the Outdoor Restoration Partnership Act. And doesn't that just sound like a nice name for a bill? Outdoor Restoration Partnership. I mean, those are some great words there. But what it really is in large measure is a bill to reduce fuels, which of course means logging. And the John Muir Project, Chad Hansen, the John Muir Project has done, you know, a wonderful job explaining why this approach is completely antithetical to the health of forests and in fact quite bad for climate change. So what I wonder is, are these folks not aware of that? Did they just not do their policy research, or do they just not care? And my guess is they just don't care. That it makes more sense to pretend that you're able to solve a problem by the very means that actually created the problem, we could add, rather than to admit that the problem is not as readily soluble as getting out chainsaws. And so I see this as part of that policy gimmickry that we get, you know, offered from time to time. And if all you did was hear those words put together in a pleasing fashion, you would think that Senator Bennett had a pro-environmental stance on these issues. And only until you take a moment to look behind the words, you realize that it's something else. And so that kind of gimmickry, I think, has been, you know, a big part of environmental policy for the last 10 to 15, maybe 20 years. And I remember successive presidential administrations coming in with similar gimmicky ideas, all of which were designed to pretend that they were doing something to support the natural world, but at the end of the day was really about window dressing and public relations. Biden's 30 by 30 is a pretty good example of exactly that same sort of thing. So in 10 years, we're going to save 30% of federal, but how much has already been lost? So why is 30% deemed any kind of a meaningful metric? And what do we really mean by saving those lands? I mean, there's all kinds of details that could make that proved to be a fairly hollow promise, which is my expectation of it. But more to the point, it's also a very minimalistic goal. It's a very minimalistic objective. It doesn't reflect the depth of the ecological problems that we're facing. If we wanted to do something meaningful about climate change, we would be protecting all of the carbon sinks, the forests, the prairies. We would not be carving out just a few of them, 30% of them. We would have an aggressive program of trying to restore those places.
You know, I interviewed Robert J. Lifton back in the early 90s, and one of the things I took away from that was he talked about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to have what he called a claim to virtue, that you had to convince yourself and others that you're actually doing a good thing. So what he was writing about the Nazis, he wrote extensively about them, so this isn't whatever that law is on the internet, that every conversation goes to Nazis really quickly. He actually did write several books about them, that before they could commit genocide and mass murder, they had to convince themselves and others that they were doing a good thing. We're not doing these horrible things. We're purifying the Aryan race. And then you can see this everywhere on every level, from personal relationships where, you know, I have never once in my life been a jerk. Every time I've actually been a jerk, I've had myself convinced that I'm the good guy. We all do this. And then on the biggest scale, you know, we're not killing the planet. We're developing natural resources. My reason for this whole long little speech is that the first time I applied that to the natural world was I was supposed to write some article for an alternative newspaper in Spokane. and they asked me to write about forest health and how the Forest Service was going in and cutting trees to improve forest health. And the editor of the paper said, that's a pretty good idea, I think. Why don't you write about that? That I think it is really helpful to cut down some trees. And I realized in that moment, I looked at the history of timber cutting, and there was a whole series of successive excuses, claims to virtue for why we need to cut trees. So there was, we need the forests are sick, they've got disease, so we need to cut them down. The forests have been hammered by logging, and so we need to cut them down. The forests have been, nowadays it's fire, so we need to cut them down. And once, for me, once I flipped over and saw that they were all just these successive excuses for further destruction, it became so much easier to see them in the future.
Yes, exactly. I think what goes along with that is the selective use of science. In my mind, it's kind of a blind faith in what science can accomplish. And I think about this relative to the Colorado River and the Glen Canyon Dam, a project that I was involved with, National Park Service's management of the Glen Canyon Dam. Because as some people may know who are listening, the Grand Canyon was, of course, created through the flows of the Colorado River. And once that river was dammed, it had significant implications for the Colorado River ecosystem. So once that was figured out in the early 1990s, Congress enacted a law that basically said, okay, study how to make this better. And that's good. That's great. But the result is that the federal government spends about $10 million a year trying to figure out how to make it better. And I just want to read from a report, this is very brief, that talks about these efforts. And so one of the management goals for the Glen Canyon Dam is meet humpback chub recovery. Humpback chub is an endangered fish, including maintaining a self-sustaining population, spawning habitat, and aggregations in the Colorado River and its tributaries below the Glen Canyon Dam. That's a mouthful all by itself, but we get the idea. We need a sustaining population, spawning habitat, and aggregations in the Colorado River and its tributaries. Now, how is this going to be accomplished? It is being addressed by identifying processes that drive spatial and temporal variation in nutrients and temperature within the Colorado ecosystem, and establishing quantitative and mechanistic links among those ecosystem drivers, primarily production and higher trophic levels, tracking the response of aquatic food-based organisms to flow and non-flow actions, monitoring of humpback chub populations, dynamics and conditions and aggregations in the main stem Colorado River, both upstream and downstream of the confluence of the Little Colorado River and within the Little Colorado River, and monitoring the status and trends of native and non-native fishes that occur in the Colorado River from Lee's Ferry to Lake Mead. So I share that because it gives some sense of the complexity of understanding what's going on with the humpback chub. And so the idea that scientists can just readily, magically understand how destroying the natural world can be repaired is just a fallacy. It's just a myth. But it's a myth that allows a dominant culture to continue to do these destructive things to the natural world. If we understood that these places cannot be put back together in any meaningful sense of that term, can they be made better? Could there be some aspects of restoration? I would guess so. But to actually have that ecosystem as it was before all of this happened, that seems impossible to me. So that kind of reliance on science to fix things, which shows up in these intensive management actions, is exactly the policy approach that I think has helped create so much of the destruction that we're living with today.
So what would be the policy approach that you would, I'm sorry if this is a stupid question, what would be the policy approach that you would suggest in its place?
Well, I think that the monitoring and all of that is perfectly appropriate. What I'm suggesting with what I read was that the mechanisms are incredibly complex.
So
leaving places.
Go ahead.
Letting natural forces, leaving systems intact as much as possible. And that, in the case of the Colorado River, that dam needs to come out. So if you actually want to try to restore that ecosystem, the dam needs to go, period.
So I'm thinking a couple lines by David Ehrenfeld. One is that nature is not only more complex than we think, nature is more complex than we're capable of thinking. And the other is that we have convinced ourselves because we can commit minor miracles like antibiotics, like open heart surgery, like having a computer, like having a telephone, that because we can commit minor miracles, therefore we can commit major miracles, like managing an entire natural community / ecosystem. And I love both of those lines.
Yes, that is exactly right. And yet that attitude undergirds federal land management, and it undergirds everything else about environmental management, as far as I can tell.
So we have about 10 or 11 minutes left, and one of the questions I wanted to ask you, and so I'm going to ask this question, but I know you didn't want me to ask this like early in the interview. So if this is still too early, I'll ask something else instead. So why did you choose to run, if you're going to run for Senate, why did you choose to run as a Democrat as opposed to independent? Or, I mean, I know the Greens are a mess, so we won't even sit. So why did you choose to run as Democrat as opposed to independent, green, and big, huge quotes, or Republican for that matter, or run as the Wolf Party, or the Prairie Dog Party, or the Front Range Party?
I think it goes back to your point about the hole in the discourse, and if these ideas are kept out of the mainstream, and I think kept out is not a bad way of thinking about it or putting it. I think that there's some, you know, intentional desire to kind of keep these ideas from you know, exposure to the rest of the world. They live in the worlds that we're familiar with, you know, community rights, nature rights, native rights, you know, animal rights, et cetera, earth rights. But those ideas don't show up quite so often in mainstream discourse. So part of it is to try to force the mainstream to think about these issues in a meaningful way. And this is true around what happens to human beings as well. I mean, my policy platform is pretty robust as it pertains to the awful things that happen to human beings that are unnecessary, things like mass incarceration and the war on drugs and treating substance abusers as criminals, et cetera. So the fact that we have a very impoverished policy conversation around so many issues is because the parties have been pretty successful at keeping these conversations out of the mix. And I saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign and some other indicators that the Democrats were having a hard time keeping a lid on that conversation. And I perceive that there could be an opening if more people kind of pushed a bit. Third party politics does not seem particularly viable in my mind, to the extent that if it's easy to ignore me as a Democratic candidate, how much easier would it be to ignore me as an independent candidate or a candidate of the Wolf Party or whatever party we wanted to come up with? So the idea was simply to try to push these ideas into the mainstream. Whether that's a good approach or a bad, I don't know. I can tell you that to the extent that I've been able to have these conversations with folks, the response has been receptive, and in some cases a little bit surprised. I think people have been a little bit surprised that they hadn't heard about these ideas before. So that's really what motivated me.
That's great, and it really reminds me of, you know, originally before I wrote A Language Older Than Words, the book was going to be somewhat different. It was really going to be a book about interspecies communication. And the interesting thing is I started asking people about it, just like if I'm on a bus, just random people. I'm at a store. I would go up to a stranger and I would ask them, and if they've ever had an example of interspecies communication. And it was the interesting thing to me was that they would say, oh yeah, I have them all the time with my dog, with my cat, with this crow who lives outside. And I would say, have you ever talked about this in public? And every single one would say, oh my God, no, because people think I'm crazy. And it's the same thing here that, you know, you can go talk to people and they can say, gosh, this makes a lot of sense, but we can't talk about it in public. And so I just think it's really great what you're doing to talk about it in public. Am I characterizing this correctly?
Yes, I think so. And it doesn't mean that I think that I have all of the policy answers, or that people couldn't understandably disagree with my approach to things. I certainly understand that and respect that possibility. But the fact that we're not even having the conversation that we should be having is what's really propelling me. We can't really be talking about dealing with climate change without talking about dealing with land use policy or agricultural policy, or how we produce goods and services in this society and around the world, for that matter. We can't really talk about climate change without talking about globalization. Until the conversation occurs at that level, then we're just being offered a series of you know, PR stunts, frankly. Just, you know, window dressing, so that the destruction can continue as it always has. And that's what I'm really being motivated around, just to try to unmask the delusion that is being foisted upon us, that we can just continue to live as we have, those of us in wealthy developed nations and who are in a position to participate in that materialistic lifestyle. I don't know if you remember a movie called Soylent Green from the early 1970s, but I think about a scene in that movie where due to the collapse of the environment and climate change, et cetera, they actually create suicide centers so that people can remove themselves from this environment and reduce the need for, you know, feeding yet another mouth. And this older character in this movie goes to this suicide center, and they're given an opportunity to have a luscious meal, which they had not been able to have because the ecosystem won't provide decent food anymore. And they get a chance to listen to music and watch whatever video they want. And this character who chooses to commit suicide watches a video of what Earth looked like before the devastation. And his friend, trying to stop the suicide, shows up at the last minute and sees this footage that he had never seen before. And he just breaks into tears. He just weeps at the sight of the beauty of the oceans and the mountains and the forests, et cetera. And it's a very moving scene for me personally, because I think that if we continue on our current trajectory, we will be offered a Soylent Green type world. We might not be eating people, okay? But we will be offered a world that is highly managed, highly controlled, very technological oriented, where all of our pleasures will be machine mediated in some form or fashion, and where our understanding of the beauty of the natural world will be deeply depleted. People of my generation still remember birdsong orchestras, where you'd hear so many birds, and it would be so incredible to hear this combination of sounds in the spring. And each year I see that orchestra becoming more like a string quartet, fewer and fewer sounds and different types of songs. People my age, I'm 60, we remember monarch butterflies and others of their brethren, right? And when was the last time anybody saw a butterfly? We remember bumblebees. When was the last time you heard a bumblebee? And so we have already been acclimated and taught to not expect these things anymore. Two flocks of geese flew over my house in the last week, and it was remarkable. And I noticed, wow, now I know this is the time of year for that, but two is just pretty impoverished. So we're being, I think, conditioned to accept a more, an increasingly depleted natural world, that we are being intentionally severed from our ties with the natural world. And I don't think that it is, I think it's intentional. I don't think it's a byproduct. And I am doing what I can to ask us collectively to rethink that trajectory, so that future generations may know something about the beauty of this planet, and so that the plants and animals can have their lives as well.
So that would be a beautiful note to end on, but I have a couple more questions. And thank you so much for that. One is, I want to highlight a phrase you said just before the Soylent Green stuff, which was just fantastic. Anyway, before then, earlier you had said, we have an impoverished public, impoverished policy discussions. And for my entire teen and adult life, I have been looking for the phrase to describe political debates and to describe newspapers and to describe so much of our public discourse. And you have summed it all up in three words: impoverished policy discussions. I love that.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
So now my really final question is, if people want to help you with this, what can they do? Or if they don't live in Colorado and they too have dreamt of moose and they love where they live and they remember bumblebees, what can they do? So what do you want people to do in Colorado and out of Colorado?
Well, in Colorado, the process for getting me on the ballot requires participation in Democratic Party precinct caucuses and county conventions, which leads to a state convention. And if I reach a threshold number of votes, then I can potentially get on the ballot. If that doesn't happen, then Michael Bennett will be the sole Democrat. He will be the Democratic nominee, and there will be no challenge to his nomination. I'm posing a challenge to his nomination. You can check out my website, BruslinForSenate2022.com. And what I think is more important than even me, because honestly, that's not my motivation at all, is to look at the policy proposals that I've put forward. I have not really had an opportunity to do them justice in this conversation today. And it's my fault for not really thinking through how to discuss these issues well. But there's a lot spelled out there. And I think that if those ideas can get picked up and pressed forward in state houses and in local governments and at the national level, I think that would be, you know, that would begin to help that dialogue be less impoverished.
And if somebody is in Illinois or Indiana and they want to pick up and join you and do this in their own state, what words of advice would you have for them? What would you want them to do?
Send me a message and I through my website and I will talk to you about what I've learned, because it has been quite a learning experience. And not so much that it's been a bad learning experience. I mean, people have been gracious and kind, and you know, people within the Democratic Party have been pleasant, and so it's not anything like that. But just kind of understanding the mechanics of what you have to do when you want to seek federal office, for example, that it's a bit of a process. And I think just being willing to contemplate yourself in that role, that honestly was the hardest thing for me as I look back on it. I've never wanted to be in the spotlight. I never enjoyed seeing my name in print when I was a spokesperson for quite a while for the Park Service. I always tried to avoid getting my name in print. I never wanted to be on camera. And so, you know, putting a website up with my name on it and, you know, sending out press releases with my name on it was all just not comfortable for me. But I've become more comfortable with it, realizing that I'm a vehicle for these ideas. This isn't really about me. It's about saving the natural world. And this is the way that I've settled on to try to accomplish that in this moment. I've done other things. I've tried to educate folks through my university work, tried to fight for the natural world in my Park Service work, the legal stuff. This is the next thing I'm trying to do. So, you know, it's a little bit of a personal growth opportunity too, like just trying to figure out, okay, who can I be in the world and how can I best defend the natural world? But I'm very much convinced that until there's significant political pressure through the political institutions of our country, we're not going to get very far in saving the natural world. I've heard others say, well, we just need to have a lot of activism in the streets. But with all due respect, if that activism doesn't translate into political power, into changed laws, into changed policies, then the activism in the street doesn't get us very far. And I think that's where we're at. So I, you know, and I'm more than mindful of the concern about co-optation, and that when you play within the political system, so to speak, that the transformative energy of whatever you're trying to accomplish gets drained out of it. And I think that there's truth to that, but failing to engage in that has brought us to where we are, I think, now, to where there aren't even significant pockets of resistance within the nonprofit world, that so much of environmentalism has become so closely tied to this, you know, very narrow way of thinking about environmental issues, that we can only think about the environment within the context of a pro-growth capitalist economy. And those two things will not work together. You cannot defend the environment without thinking about the need to tackle the pro-growth aspects of our economy.
Again, that would be a beautiful place to end, but I'm going to ask you one more question, which is, can you give us just one quick story of some wild place or wild being you love? And it can be from your childhood, it can be a meadowlark now, it can be just one quick glimpse of one either wild being or wild place.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, and I'll just preface my answer here by saying that part of what I have learned, I think, is that when we are all given the chance to understand what kind of a relationship we can have with the natural world, that we are all enriched by that. And I think that part of how people are kept oppressed in this society is by denying them access to the natural world. I'm thinking about a video I saw on PBS NewsHour the other night in an impoverished area in Baltimore. And there was just no sign of anything natural or beautiful in the areas that they showed. What would it be like to live under those kinds of conditions? And so I think that bringing nature back into all of our lives is an absolute predicate toward human well-being. For myself, I've long had a close connection with meadowlarks, and meadowlarks make this incredibly beautiful sound, and they're still plentiful, but of course, like everything else, their numbers are declining. And years ago, when my mother was terminally ill, she loved meadowlarks too. And the hospital that we went to, there was still open lands around. And as we would go in and out for her treatment, the meadowlarks would be singing to us. And it was a very meaningful thing for both of us. After she passed, I noticed meadowlarks singing near my house, like right outside my door. And they were so, I think it was just one bird. And he was so loud, and it is a he because, as I understand it, meadowlarks, only male meadowlarks sing. But he was so loud that he would wake me up, and I would be so excited to hear his song that it would just propel me out of bed, and I'd run to the window to try to see him. And this persisted for a number of days. And it was at the time of my most deep grief, and that bird gave me hope that I could survive the grief. And so I think that healing power is there for all of us. But we are being encouraged to turn to Facebook or Netflix rather than to the forces that can really heal us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for all of that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Karen Breslin. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.